go explain evolution to the monkeys.
God damn you all!
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Cinema d'Amore. This is Cinema d'Amore. That was a different opening, a very special opening for, which is obviously our Planet of the Apes theme. I'm here with Chuck today.
Yeah.
That was Chuck. We're going to be talking about every single Planet of the Apes films. All of them. Every single one. Classic, Tim Burton remake.
The classic Tim Burton remake, that's what you're saying?
Yeah, I guess the way that I phrased it, it was the classic, comma, the remake, and I thought you were going to say something, comma, and the latest Planet of the Apes trilogy, which they are planning on running into the original Planet of the Apes storyline, so eventually one day it will no longer be a trilogy, but at the current time, the current trilogy.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get something more. I don't think Apes is dead.
I'll look into the remake numbers when we get into the remake numbers, but obviously the very first Planet of the Apes was a success critically and financially. Like, it was a profitable film. And Rise, Dawn, War, all the new ones, same story. They were critically praised and they succeeded financially. I think, obviously, it's probably the social commentary on it that keeps everything going so strong. Today's episode, we're going to be doing 9 episodes total, is Planet of the Apes from 1968, which is by John Schaffner.
I thought it was Franklin Schaffner. Yeah, Franklin J. Schaffner.
The J is John, I guess.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, he directed Patton. And I saw from his bio that was really interesting. He was born and raised in Tokyo. So I don't know if that had a lot of influence on his style. I really wouldn't say Patton has a Japanese style. But this, I guess, could. Planet of the Apes kind of does.
I totally see it. It's like, you know, Godzilla and Planet of the Apes are practically the same movie.
I wasn't thinking kaiju as much as, like, the way that they treat, like, the villages. And, I mean, I guess it kind of fits the Japanese 70s sci-fi films, too. So it really kind of embodies a lot of it.
Yeah.
He would have been raised in, like, the 50s or something. So he would have been raised with Godzilla, the classics. This is based on a book by Robert Boulay. Did you know that, Chuck?
I did, because I watched the behind-the-scenes features.
Yeah, it helps to watch or listen to something so you know how things are said. He wrote the book that became, in America, known as Planet of the Apes, and in the UK, known as Monkey Planet. We missed out on Monkey Planet.
Much better title in America. Yeah, way better title.
We could have had the Monkey Planet podcast right now, which just sounds more like a Planet Earth thing.
Dawn of the Monkey Planet.
Oh, I haven't known. It's probably all backwards.
I want to see War for the Monkey Planet.
I think it would just be like Monkey Planet War, Monkey Planet Dawn. Like something even worse. I feel like it would just get worse, like a lot worse. Yeah, I mean, this is a prolific science fiction film.
Before doing any research, I had always thought that Rod Serling had just written this script. I didn't realize that it was something that he worked on, and his idea was worked upon, that there were rewrites on top of his ideas. I just always thought it was him.
Essentially, it wasn't greenlit because they said that his stuff was too expensive. He had it take place in, like, a more modern time, like the 20th century.
That's how the book is, too.
Which follows the book, yeah. There's, like, some things in the book that end up popping up here and there, like, throughout the series. But they're drastically different. They're, like, really, really different. The societal stuff is the same, which we'll get into. But the twist is played kind of differently. Everything goes down pretty differently. I think Rod Serling, definitely, like, the societal things, and as well as the twist, just screams Twilight Zone. Like, this feels to me as if this is the closest thing that we have to a Twilight Zone movie. Not including the Twilight Zone movie. I'm not including that. I'm not including the anthology movie that they had, which had, what, like, one new story in it?
Yeah. I think the one where the kids ended up dying in, I think that was the only new one.
Or if you want to count that, like, Dan Aykroyd opening.
Yeah, I guess technically.
But yeah, 2001, it was in the U.S. National Film Registry. It won an honorary Academy Award for makeup, Sean Chambers got, which Yeah, I guess I know we already discussed it. I can't remember what was the first movie that had makeup awards.
The first actual Academy Award for makeup was An American Werewolf in London, which that was probably the episode that we discussed it on, I'm assuming.
That would be a good assumption.
Yeah, that'd be a strong idea there that's where we talked about it from. Yeah, the Planet of the Apes and the Seven Faces of Dr. Lao were the first two that won the special Academy Award in 64 and 68. So it wasn't until 1981 that they started doing makeup Oscars. But yeah, this movie definitely deserves it for that makeup work, which John Chambers, I think most people might I guess know that. I don't want to say the character, but he is the person that John Goodman's playing in Argo. That's who he's playing in that film. So I don't know, maybe that's where most people would know if you were to throw that fact out, that did you see Argo? He's John Goodman.
I know in the beginning, like when they were starting to come up with this, like Charlton Heston was always attached. Edward G. Robinson was attached. Yeah, and I mean, I guess, and probably the most prolific besides Rod Serling is maybe Jerry Goldsmith, who scored a ton of things that we love. I didn't even know that he scored things like The Mummy with Brendan Fraser, but he did Poltergeist and LA Confidential. And I read that he did the Universal Studios like opening logo at 97. I don't know if he still did it.
It's interesting.
When you saw The Lost World, that's the very first time they used his opening score for that.
Yeah, I do enjoy the score for this a lot. That's one of the few soundtracks that I owned on CD because it only cost a quarter at the CD warehouse. So it was a real steal there. It was in the clearance bin.
Yeah, that is pretty good. CDs used to be like $13, so 25 cents is pretty good. 15 bucks for 50 cent. 25 cents for
Apes.
Planet of the Apes soundtrack. Yeah. I know he was working on some other stuff up to his death. He was working on Timeline, which was the Paul Walker film. They edited the movie so heavily that they couldn't use his score anymore. And then they had to rescore it because he was already getting up there. Like, he wasn't able to complete it.
It's a little disappointing. Could have had one final great score, I guess. I mean, that movie's not good, so
it might have been good when he scored it.
Yeah, might have been good at the time that he was working on it, and then they edited it. I mean, that's such an interesting idea of, hey, I wrote the music for your movie, and then they edited it so heavily that they couldn't even use the score. Like, so how much did it change? They yeah, cut it so doesn't match badly up at all. It doesn't even match at all. We can't even remotely use it. Like, how badly did you change that movie? And it didn't come out better, so.
All the Planet of the Apes movies, I think, work really, really well by just putting somebody, like, giving the average person an outsider's perspective of things. Charlton Heston's character, Taylor, he definitely seems to come from a place of privilege, for sure. There was that weird thing that they bring up in this too, where Stewart, the one woman that went with them, she died from her hibernation chamber, like leaking. But they like have one sentence in the middle of the thing that they were basically like, she was basically there to be bred. And I was thinking, well, Jesus Christ, you think they would want to go the opposite way? I'm making it worse, but you think they would want like more women than just, you know, one, because that's the way that you're going to start the population, not have one person die and then you can't even complete it if you needed to.
There's so many things in this movie that were taken directly from Twilight Zone episodes, because that's what happens in, I know that's the one, I think it's the Rip Van Winkle caper, where they steal gold from an armored truck, and their plan is to go into glass coffins for like 100 years or something in a cave, and then when they wake up, they'll sell off the gold because they figure no one will be looking for the gold after 100 years. And I know that's like one of the characters is like a rock falls off the roof of the cave and smashes his thing, and they're like, oh, he's probably been dead for 50 years at this point. There's all sorts of little things that are interesting after you watch Twilight Zone and Planet of the Apes. The whole idea, I guess, of like watching the film and coming from like the beginning where it seems like they're on some sort of like foreign planet, but then finding out that they've actually been on Earth the entire time is, I think that's the episode with Charles Bronson. I think he's in it, and there's another woman in there.
That's like a couple Twilight Zone episodes.
There's a couple Twilight Zone episodes that are like that, where it's like, yeah, I think Bronson's in the one from like the third or fourth season where it's him and this other girl. And I think, yeah, they don't talk the entire time, but they're just like kind of wandering around, and it looks like they're...
Is that the Adam and Eve one?
Yeah, and it's like, they look like they're in like some sort of like lost jungle or something, but then they get to like a gas station or something, and it's revealed that they've been walking around like a after like the nuclear holocaust or something like that, and they're like the last two people on Earth. And so it's interesting like how many of those little ideas that he kind of like picked out of his own old stories and kind of inserted into here.
There's some things that I think are like are interesting. I think there's a line where they're like, the shuttle wasn't made to land in water, yet it had a raft. I also like when they were sinking, they still had time to check the air that it worked. I'm assuming if they had more money, because a lot of money went into the costume, and I would say a lot of the money went into the design. It is a really good looking film, but they made it more primitive because that was the only workaround that they could have to like cut the budget, which Michael Wilson, that rewrote the screenplay, he said he pretty much only changed dialogue and stuff to make it fit that primitive. Like, he kept the entire structure of the Rod Serling script, which I can see, because when I watched it, I thought, this screams Rod Serling. And then when I realized that his script was the one that got rejected and rewritten, I'm like, what the hell could they have included, changed in it? But it was just, I guess, the dialogue and stuff. I saw that the director is the one that added that when they're doing the trial and their orangutans do the monkey thing that's like, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. And I'm sure I said that in the wrong order, but that was his idea. I feel like all the kind of goofy things are definitely the director or some sort of like improv things.
Yeah, you know, it was monkeys and, you know, they threw that in there. Yeah, do you think he came up with the line, you know what they say, human see, human do? Like, just like way over the top, throwing out all the puns.
For the most part, all the social stuff holds up really well in this movie. There's some tiny, like, logistical things that I think are just, maybe they just don't work as well as they should. Like, when they're dodging those rocks and they're, like, act like they're, like, the effects don't kind of match what they're running from. So they're, like, all beat up. I love the scene where they're walking through this desert. Dodge, third astronaut that survived, is way ahead of the other ones. And you can see him. And he turns around and he's like, guys, over here. And he's waving them down and they start running. And these are people that need to conserve their energy. It's like another thing that in the script, I'm sure it worked out a little bit differently. But in the film, you see him and they're definitely following him. It's not like he popped out of nowhere and was like, guys, up here, I found something. Because then he leads them down the hill to this tiny ass plant. So he has hawk vision, because the guy wasn't down that hill and then back up the hill. I mean, you can tell from the footprints too. I'm not trying to be too logistical.
You're getting a little logistical there.
I'll get more logistical.
Getting pretty logistical into a movie with talking apes, and your biggest issue is a guy's vision.
It's not a movie just about apes. That's the perspective of the idiot, Chuck. You're not an idiot. I like when they go swimming and they start getting their clothes stolen by the natives, and all the clothes are like in drastically different places. I'm like, were they all on a completely different side of this lake or whatever before they decided to go into it? That's another thing that's set up really nicely, where the spaceship sinks. We find out they're in a place called the Forbidden Zone, so no one's really going out there. All their clothes are kind of stolen. I guess not enough for them to know that Charlton Heston's character is a little bit different, because he still has like his underwear or something, but they know it's not native. They're like, that's not what they wear. There's something, I've never seen clothes like that at all. Between his crew, you're thinking, oh man, they gotta be able to... Like, you think something, like, one person would escape or go somewhere else, but they all get it. Like, the Landon gets lobotomized, and then you find out that Dodge ended up getting, like, killed. And then, like, he's shot. You see him shot in, like, the neck, and then he's, a taxidermy person, which is probably the creepiest shot in the whole movie, when they show him and it looks like something from, what's that RKO film? I Walked with the Zombie. That's what it looks like.
I still enjoy that scene like when they just it still like surprises me every time, even though I've seen this movie so many times. Just the way it's like has something to do with like the way it's edited, of just you don't know what it is at first. You just see like those sticks coming through the fields, or like they're like waving those giant like bamboo sticks or something around, and you're like, oh, what kind of monster is going to come out? And then it's just apes running through, and then they do that great zoom on that one ape,
yeah, like that crash
very
zoom.
First, yeah, that very first one, like he turns or he whips back real fast and looks at the camera, and it just zooms right in on him, and you're like, oh no, apes. That's such a great moment. I love that scene every time it happens in the movie. Every time I've watched it, I always
there's like, one in the one of the later films that does that for me too. It has that crash zoom. It's like probably the funniest opening. I don't know, funny is exactly what they're going for, but yeah, that crash zoom, and because it's more like it's more of a shock the way that it's done, because the first thing you hear is like the gorillas screaming, and they sound like it could be some huge monster, and all these humans that they have found that are very primitive are running away. They're afraid of it. And then, yeah, you see them, like, whipping around, like, the bamboo sticks, the staffs or whatever they have, and the horses. So it is kind of more shocking, I guess, to see them riding the horses. And
like, I guess they don't really, like, over-explain or make you have to realize this type of thing. Like, you just kind of pick this up from watching it, is the way, you know, the apes try to talk about how they're above humans, and they don't do the things that humans did that destroyed everything, you know, the way they talk about it. But a lot of the things they do are still exactly the same, and it's kind of built in a little bit in the, you know, like we were saying, like the social kind of aspect of it, like having there's a very clear class system. The gorillas are like the menial labor and army type. The chimps are more like just the standard like workers and doctors. And then you get to the orangutans that are the like politicians and like faith leaders, like clergy or something like that, that they definitely like still have a structure where everyone has their place. You know, it doesn't seem like a chimp could ever be a soldier, the same way a gorilla could never be a doctor. They all have their places that they have to stay, and they can't look to do anything differently. So it's interesting to see things like that. And again, like they don't specifically point it out to you. It's not something that Taylor like says, oh, why are the orangutans the leaders, and why are the gorillas the army people? Like, he doesn't have to tell you. It's just something you can pick up, which I enjoy, that, you know, the movie doesn't feel like it has to hold your hand and over explain ape society. It's very much they just show you ape society, and you pick up the little clues as to those type of things.
Or when they finally do explain some things, it's subtle, and it's not this super expository thing, such as like they talk down on the chimps, and I think they kind of say it. There's a line where they say something like, yeah, we're chimps. We don't get the respect that the others get.
That's the line from Taylor, because Zaius says, all apes are created equal, and he says, well, it seems like some apes were created more equal than others.
Charlton Heston is a weird actor. I also find it weird. I get that this is decades ago, but when Zero's trying to talk to Charlton Heston when he's injured, I mean, the guy got shot in the throat and just lost his voice for a little bit. She's asking him questions, and he can understand. And they do have the thing where, like, he can write, which, I mean, it's a good thing that it's written exactly how they speak, you know, like it's still English. But she asked him questions, and if I was him, I mean, maybe it would ruin the story, or they'd have to rewrite the story a lot more. But if you're asking me questions, like yes or no questions, I could probably nod my head, assuming that they would know what it meant, you know? Maybe they don't. Maybe that would be something where it's like, do you understand me? And you're like shaking your head yes, and like, I don't know what that means. We don't nod for things that we understand. We don't shake our heads for things that we don't understand. But yeah, he doesn't try to like point, like when he attacks her to get that notepad to write like a sentence, a really well-written sentence that didn't look like he was rushed to write it in 2 seconds. But you think he could have pointed and then like, give it to me. But he doesn't. And I would like to just think that's because Charlton Heston's Taylor's character is a little stupider than we think. That's just what I like to think. That's my fan theory.
Oh, you're really, really dissecting this movie to the smallest degree, aren't you, today?
No, well, I don't know.
Really, really getting into the tiny details there. Like, Zaius, I think, is maybe one of the more interesting characters in the film. Out of anybody, I mean, most of the human characters aren't really that interesting. Even Charlton Heston isn't really that interesting.
Nova's the most interesting one.
And Zira and Cornelius, obviously, they become more of the leads in future films, even than they are in this one. But I do like the character of Zaius. Like, I think he's very interesting in that he does very much seem to be, even out of the other orangutans, he seems to be the only one that truly understands anything, like truly knows where they came from, or even has any kind of idea as to any sort of history of the apes, anything pre their society. Even the other orangutans that are on like the council just seem to kind of just go along with whatever he says. He's not even the main person at like that tribunal they have, but they all kind of just defer to him in general, just because he's like, oh, I know about that. I know that type of stuff. And so it is interesting the way his character just constantly is manipulating everything, even though he's usually just like sitting in the background, not really doing anything. I don't know. He comes across at least in this film as like I said, probably the most interesting character in this film.
He's definitely a well-written character for sure. Obviously, this feels like it influenced something like Lost, where you have these villains that, you know, they keep changing with the information that they know. And you get subtle hints, like when he makes the paper airplane and the chimps are all impressed. When Zaius comes in and they're like, just throw it. And he crumbles it up. I always felt he crumbled it up because he knew what it was and he knew what it was going to do. So he knows more than he's letting on. But yeah, he definitely seems smarter than the other orangutans because he seems to just know more than they know. And I don't feel that I don't feel like a lot of them were keeping secrets like he was. But I do like when you build towards the climax of this movie and you get the reveal of humans were on this planet before the apes were, because they have that talking doll and stuff. And you think that it would be this big revelation, and the bigger revelation is that Zaius already knows about it. He's not even shocked by it.
Yeah, it's interesting that that final scene where they're in the cave and he's going through all the items and Taylor's telling him, you know, oh, these are glasses and these are dentures, and you know, he keeps going through what all these items are. And it's interesting the way they play Zaius. He's obviously, again, the orangutans are kind of like the politicians, and they're also kind of like a clergy figure. And he kind of brings up, you know, kind of that same way of you can kind of read into anything in any way. Like, you know, Christians can interpret one story one way, and then, you know, Muslims can interpret the exact same story their way, just the way it kind of fits their religious view. And he kind of does the same thing where he says, oh, none of that proves anything. I could tell you any of that stuff could be for anything. You know, you don't have the proof that's exactly what that thing's for. I could make up my own reasons for what it is,
like,
and everyone would
Israel
believe.
And like Israel and Palestine, kind of a thing, kind of writing these other people out of history because they don't fit the religion. Or I think in this particular movie, I feel that there's some kind of apocalyptic thing that happened, and obviously it's the humans' fault. The apes seem as if they're going down the same path because they're becoming more human-like, and they're not necessarily learning from, I mean, I guess they don't know. Zaius knows, but they're not learning from the mistakes of the past, even if it's a different species. But I do. I enjoy the fact that he's layered. He is the villain of the movie, but his intentions are, he thinks for keeping these secrets, he's doing it for the good. He's evil enough that he'll risk a few lives fuck it, kill these three chimpanzees that are out here, and the rest of society can live just fine.
Yeah, he definitely, I guess, falls into that category of the villain that thinks he's the hero. He thinks he's protecting everybody, and it is interesting because it almost does seem like if more of the apes knew of the history of the humans, that they might actually try to act differently. They might not try to keep going down the same path because they just see themselves as, superior, and they can just walk all over everybody. And we kind of get that a little more in the second film of, they want to start expanding and drive.
I think at the very least, they're afraid of. Yeah, I think at the very least, they're afraid of division. If people can make up their own minds, things are going to get split. And we've seen that in the real world, at least currently in the world that me and you are living in. I've personally seen it where you can give information and everyone has the same information and it's split 50-50. That's, I guess, free will for you. But Zaius is a character that doesn't believe in free will. I think the nice thing, too, is the commentary is completely on actual situations and actual human behavior. I would be interested to see who specifically Rod Serling had in mind when he was coming up with these types of ideas, because what I see from the book, like the trial and stuff, never took place. There wasn't a whole lot that ended up making it from the book into the movie, which I haven't read the book, so I can't actually do a comparison. And I didn't read Rod Serling's script, like his unedited script. But I kind of feel like it was almost would be better. Maybe just because I like Rod Serling and that's what I want it to be. But I feel like his type of adaptation, like this is a guy that definitely had something to say. He always has had something to say. And I'm with you. I think Twilight Zone is probably one of the greatest television shows ever to come out, because just the skill that guy had to be able to tell a story and hide it as something else. Like, he really, really does a good job at picking up, like you say, I'm breaking things apart too small. And I know I am, maybe not necessarily on a psychological level, but he fucking is when he's writing this stuff. He's really, really, really thinking about it. And just subtle things like, and I know they did take it from the book, but after the gorillas had captured and killed some of the humans, they're taking their photo with them like they were on the big hunt, and they were so clever at killing them. And it just gives you this completely different perspective that totally fits in today's standards, where like you have these rich people going out to the safari to hunt a tiger that's already sedated, and they take their picture with this tiger that they shot. But it's not even like the illusion is that they didn't go in the woods and hunt this tiger down by themselves. This tiger was pretty much handed to them because they had the money to do it. And in this movie, it's kind of the same. It's like a bunch of people that have no weapons and you have guns, and they're clearly not the smartest. I even say to an extent the gorillas aren't the smartest. The net stuff really wasn't working that well. They love their nets. They went crazy with nets. I think my favorite part was when they threw the net over Charlton Heston in the city and then jumped down and pulled him up. I was like, damn, those stunt people. When are they going to get an Academy Award?
No, everyone's, yeah. The Academy Award for stunts, and, Andy Serkis getting his Academy Award for, maybe some of his later apes things that we'll get into. They should be recognized. I did think it was interesting, too. I didn't realize until I watched this film that Pierre Boulez, who did this, I thought this was the only like book of his that I had ever been aware of. I did not know he also wrote The Bridge on the River Kwai, which is a weird, like, those movies don't seem like they'd be related, but he did the, he did both of those books, which again, I thought was very interesting because I think The Bridge on the River Kwai is a great movie. I really love that movie. Obviously different tone, not sci-fi, but
yeah, that, know, real serious, it's war
a, it's
tone.
A, yeah. Too, it's a real serious prison movie, which was written, the script for that was written by Michael Wilson, who did the rewrites on this one.
Yeah.
But he had to remain uncredited on Bridge on the River Kwai because he was blacklisted.
Yeah. I think when he did this, he was unblacklisted.
I would assume so, since his name, since he got his name on the credits. But I don't know, that was an interesting thing that when I was watching the behind the scenes, that, like I said, I wasn't aware of when they were talking about the making of it, of, oh yeah, and they wanted to bring a writer in, so they got the writer that did Bridge on the River Kwai, and I'm like, why would they do that? And then they're like, they brought him in because that was Pierre Boulez's other big novel, and I'm like, oh, that's an interesting fact that I was not even remotely aware of, that.
I mean, the social issues are there, but that's like the biggest similarity between the two of them.
Yeah. So this is a little interesting trivia that I picked up on the behind the scenes of the movie. But yeah, I guess he hated, as far as I'm aware, he hated this adaptation of the book.
Who, Michael Wilson?
No, Pierre Boulez. He hated the
Boulez hated it.
He hated it because it, I guess, because enough of it was changed, and he said I guess he didn't like all the social things. Like, I think he basically just wrote it as, oh, what if, you know, what if apes took over the world, like, kind of thing. Like, not, like, he didn't write it, I guess, with as serious of an intention, or wasn't adding, like, all of those layers that Rod Serling was adding in there.
I think the only thing that he really has in there is he does have, like, the classes between the two between the three main types of apes. They're pretty much exactly the same.
Yeah.
Gorillas are military.
I guess
I know the
other, the big twist at the ending isn't in the book, because it's not specified that it ever takes place on Earth. It's supposed to be just a Earth-like planet. So I guess that was another thing that he hated.
They do have like a twist, but it's different. I guess there's, from what I read, there's two astronaut characters that are like, I don't know, rich in space, and they basically find like a message in a bottle, and they read the message in a bottle, which is the whole story of Planet of the Apes, and then they land back on Earth, and I guess they're greeted by like a gorilla, and then when they take off their masks, they're like chimpanzees or something. And this reminds me of the Twilight Zone. They just kind of like laugh off the idea of like intelligent humans, and like that's how it ends. So it is Earth. It is Earth, but it doesn't happen. Like, the surprise isn't obvious. It isn't to the Charlton Heston character. Well, there isn't really a Charlton Heston character in the book, but I guess the protagonist of the story of Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it is that is one of the great, great endings. I'm glad they, obviously, once you've seen it once, you know what the ending is, and that's like such an iconic image. But I know there was something else that they said they had. I think the director, I can't remember if it was the director or someone else, or if it was the director that wanted it and the producer wanted it out, or the producer wanted it and the director wanted it out. But something about,
way not to be confusing, yeah, Chuck.
I'm throwing out all sorts of stuff
there. I don't know. Understand what you're going with at all.
Well, somebody wanted to put in more like signs up on the buildings in the Ape City saying like bomb shelter and things like that, like more clues that they were on, like 100% definitely on Earth, I guess. And somebody like made the executive decision of, no, you have to save it for the big ending. Like, it has to
be. I feel like that would be Rod Serling. I feel like his script would be just, let's let everyone think that it's a different planet.
Yeah.
Because I think the movie does a good job too of, when they do discover people, they're disappointed that they essentially found a species that's identical to them. But then Charlton Heston has that line where he's like, well, you know, in like a couple weeks we'll be rolling them. Like, his idea is that is that they're so intelligent, they're completely going to be able to take over these people. He wasn't ready for the apes. I also like, too, when they get to Ape City and they have, like, the scarecrows up. And now this is the first sign. I think it's the first sign of, you didn't see people at this point yet. So they see these like, we'll say man-made things, but something that was made and not natural. And the other astronauts, Landon and Dodge, are skeptical. But Charlton Heston's character says something like, well, let's find out what's back there. And they just go. Like, I don't know. Like, it seemed almost like a horror film. You know, something modern would have been like a Blair Witch thing. You know, like you see the Blair Witch shit dangling in trees. And somebody says, what's that about? And then you go, I don't know. Let's go explore it. Let's go check it out and see. I don't know. Charlton Heston's a weird character. He's a weird actor. Like the line at the end when he discovers that it's Earth, that is, we play in the beginning of this episode, it's so iconic. But if you watch his performance, it's weird and stiff. Like it's like a weird, I don't know, it kind of reminds me of that John Oliver clip where they showed Mr. Smith goes to Washington and he calls Jimmy Stewart a terrible actor, where he like passes out on the floor.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's just
the style,
that generation, the acting style. Yeah, that generation of acting, which was, he was just before, you know, he predates like character actors or not character actors, like method actors. Like it definitely is like, you know, okay, read your line. Oh, damn you all to hell. Okay, cut. And then he's just like, okay, I'm going back to my trailer. Like there's no like character investment. Like he doesn't create like a backstory for himself. He's just there and reads his lines. So it's, that's one of those things of, I don't know, just that era of acting and film stars that if they're not cast in just the right thing, they just always come off terrible. It's like, I don't know. That's like someone like Gregory Peck's pretty good, but I've seen some movies with him where it's just not good for his demeanor or something like that. And he comes off as like the worst actor you've ever seen in your life. But then you'll see him in something like To Kill a Mockingbird and be like, oh man, he's really great. So the same with Jimmy Stewart. Like I've seen stuff with him in it and I'm like, oh, he's amazing. But then you do see some of those other things like John Oliver points out and you're like, I don't know. He kind of seems like a terrible actor.
That's even one of his good movies.
Yeah. It's not even one of his bad ones, but he still sometimes comes across as like not that good. And Charlton Heston's the same way. Like, you know, he's not the worst in this film, but I mean, what are some of his other big things? The Ten Commandments.
I mean, he's good in that. I think it's, I think it helps because it's more like stoic. It's more like a legend, you know, both of them kind of.
Yeah, it's just, it fits more of his.
If it's a biblical story, I guess.
If it's more of his, like, limited acting range, whereas, like, something like this, which definitely calls for more, I don't know, nuance and...
Well, I think we talked about it. Were we the ones that were we just talked about it in general, where we were talking about Jimmy Stewart again and some of these Westerns that he was in? He's believable until he's supposed to be, like, screaming and yelling at people, and then it's just, like, he's not intimidating at all anymore.
Yeah, we were talking about that because, we brought that up when we were talking about It's a Wonderful Life. It's the same with, like, Rope. Like, I really like Rope, and he's great in that movie all the way up until that very final scene where he starts screaming, like, oh, and they're going to put you in the chair, and oh, you're going to die, and he starts, like, screaming, and you're just like, the whole rest of that movie, he's great in the rest of that movie when he's a lot more subtle in everything he does, but when he just starts screaming like that. So yeah, I don't know. It's just
I'll kill you. Yeah,
just that era and just certain actors.
I think I was watching, what was it? Winchester 76. I think that's the title of it. But yeah, he's really good in that until he's yelling and screaming. And then you're just like, what the hell? You're not intimidating at all.
Yeah. I don't know. Some guys can just do it better. Like from that time where they could just like, they really could adapt to playing like more stoic characters or playing kind of the over the top characters. Like Robert Mitchum's from the same era. And I pretty much like anything that he's in because he feels like he's more of an actor that can just like slip into any role that you give him, and he really like takes his time and like invests in his character, like the way he's playing it. Everything I've seen Mitchum in, whether he's the villain in something like Cape Fear or Night of the Hunter, or when he plays more of a hero character, like I recently watched Out of the Past not that long ago, and that's a great movie. I think he plays that really
I just
well.
Watched Blood on the Moon like last year, and I was like, oh my god, this is so good. He's a villain. He's a villain in that.
I mean, he is most of the time. It's very, very rare that he's not the villain. But
Charlton Heston, I think I don't dislike him, but I don't feel like he is the best choice for this movie. He comes across more of as like a blockhead than a scientist. He, like, I don't know, like some of the stuff that he even says. Well, which way are we gonna go? That way. Is there any reason why? Like, no.
Yeah, he's like the cool guy that walks away from explosions, like, and just drops lines like that. Like, no, we're just going that way because I said so.
Or if he was a younger guy, maybe it would make sense. Like, he wasn't the captain, but now he's in charge because the captain's the one that died, and you know, while they were out in space. I also like their beards too. Like, they have really nice, well groomed beards. And then he shaves it off like perfectly at the end of the movie. Like,
for 2000 years, I feel like they should have longer nails and longer hair.
Even if they didn't know about it, like maybe scruffy and not like such clean lines. Like, it's like well groomed. Like, it's like as if they had the perfect beard lines when they woke up. I don't know, have some machine that shaves them while they're sleeping. Cuts their toenails and stuff.
Yeah, this is, I don't know, for any faults this movie has or anything with the performance, I don't know, I still come back to it all the time. It's still always been one of my favorites since I saw it when I was a kid. Of, I don't know, just has that good quality.
You're right, you're definitely right. I'm just picking out things that I thought of as I recently watched it. My main thought watching it's the same, though. It holds up really well. Like, the science fiction's really good. The intrigue, I think, is the best part. Everything's interesting. Like, they land on this planet. What is this planet? It starts to be like survival. Then it slowly gets more interesting to the point where, like we said, the reveals end up coming with Dr. Zaius. You know, like, that's when you... when you think you know everything that you possibly can know, this guy's still holding back. So, like, it does. It progresses really nicely. Like, I don't know. What's the runtime on it? Is it over 2 hours? Two-hour movie?
No, it's just under 2 hours.
It feels like it has at least five mini sections. Like, I felt like it had, like, five 20-minute, like, stories that were all completely different.
Yeah, I like the look. I do like the look of the movie too, especially in that, I guess, kind of like the second section when they're on the, I guess maybe still pretty early on when they first get on the planet, and this is one of those movies shot in Panavision, so it's like that ultra wide screen, which is like, it's great because it does really like add to the scale of everything. Like, they do seem like they are just in the middle of nowhere in some of those shots when you can just see these like ant-like figures walking across this enormous.
I mean, they are. I think they're in Arizona. They're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I think it looks great to like watch stuff like that when you just see these figures, and probably a good blend of. I'm sure they used some like matte paintings or something for some of those backdrops in certain shots, but others you could just tell they are just literally wandering around the desert.
Yeah, I even like when they shot the end of this movie with Charlton Heston on the beach, they shot it on the California coast, but they apparently shot it at a place where you couldn't like walk down to. So they literally had to drop people and horses and everything down there by helicopter, which I think is kind of cool and maybe kind of risky. It definitely has the wrong look of an East Coast beach. It definitely has that, like, much rockier vibe of, like, the West Coast that, you know, I'm thinking more like the Goonies or something like that. But I think it works really well with the final reveal of the Statue of Liberty being washed up on the beach, because, I mean, maybe it's too heavy or something, but from where it's at in New York, it could easily, like, have went out to sea and kind of, like, washed back up. And it's such a cool reveal where they choose to go with the reaction of Charlton Heston first. And, you know, I was born in 1986, so by the time I watched this, I knew going in that they were on Earth. I knew that he was going to find the Statue of Liberty. I would love to go into that movie completely unaware that that was going to happen. I almost feel like it would be that Simpsons joke where he ruins the Empire Strikes Back, or how the Sixth Sense was kind of like, if I didn't see that, like the first weekend that came out, I guarantee you within a week or two, it would have been spoiled for me. And I feel like Planet of the Apes would definitely be that way too. A buddy of ours would be like, hey, you know, they're on Earth the whole time. Fuck you. Thanks. But yeah, if I could Eternal Sunshine my memory, maybe I'd erase the knowledge of this movie so I could go in fresh.
That'd be a good use of that technology. That's what I want. Is it someone can make a short film on somebody coming up with the technology to erase a film from your mind so you can watch it fresh again? Like, make it like weird. Like, I want to watch the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I want you to erase all that knowledge. I want to go into it fresh again, like the first time I watched it.
My version of that story would be that they erase their memory of Lord of the Rings, and then you think the characters are going to be all excited to watch it for the first time, but they keep looking at the runtime, and they're like, I don't know if I have time for that yet.
They're somehow disappointed in it now because they don't have any information at all about it. They don't even care anymore.
Yeah, they like it when they see it, but beforehand they're like, this is just way too long. It's like a 12-hour movie. I can't sit there and watch all this. Yeah, that would be great. I think everything comes together really well in this movie. I can't compare it to the book. I didn't read the book. It's just kind of like spark notes shit that I did read. Some ideas from the book clearly fall into later in the classic series, and even Tim Burton takes some things from the book too. But yeah, just, I don't know, everything works the way that, like, it's the exact type of storytelling that I enjoy. It has that mystery, knowing what we knew when we were going into it that it was Earth already, but I don't think I knew that Zaius and maybe some other monkeys. Obviously, Cornelius has discovered something that lets him know that something about the ancient society, and he has a theory, a running theory about what's happened. So in that context, it works really well, even knowing what's going to happen. It's very interesting. Like, the trial doesn't get old. It's, for being primitive, it is very modern. It's just a primitive set, I guess. But I do like the little snippets you see, too. Like, the funeral's a nice little thing. Yeah, I think they cut back, too, where they don't have access to, like, aerospace stuff. So they don't... I guess there must be some sort of astronomers, because they believe in planets, or they understand Charlton Heston when he's talking about planets and coming from space. So they must have some sort of science fiction of their own, but they don't have any way to leave the planet.
Yeah.
Yet.
Yeah, yet. They'll get there one day. It's an interesting movie. It's an interesting film to blow up, I guess, the way it did. You know, it was pretty popular for its day.
Pun intended, yeah, for the next movie.
Pun intended on that one. I don't know, that whole original series, and obviously we're gonna keep getting into that, is one of the more bizarre, I don't know, a bizarre set of five films that are connected in maybe the strangest ways possible, the way that they the way that they keep linking together from one film to the next is, you know, this movie ends and you're thinking to yourself, it doesn't necessarily immediately lend itself to the idea of a sequel. Like, it kind of very much ends seemingly like, oh, well, that's it. You know, they're on Earth and the apes have taken over. There's not really anything to do. And as we'll get into the, when we start talking about the next film next time, interesting way that they form a sequel out of that. And then when they've seemingly written themselves into a corner, when you're thinking, well, they can't possibly make a third movie, and then they still figure out a way to get a third film out of this. Like, so I'm going to enjoy talking about this because I really don't even want to say I hate any of the Apes movies. Tim Burton's probably my least favorite out of all of them, but I
think I'm in the same boat as you.
I just don't like it that much. I think there's a lot of, I think he made a lot of dumb choices in that movie, but I don't even like really hate that movie. Obviously there's varying qualities to them, and it definitely seems like it just depended on, did they get a good director for this one? Cause the quality of these first five films, they get like, this first one is, oh yeah, the guy that did Patton and Papillon, like he did some pretty major films. And then the next one is, I don't even remember the director of the next film. I'd have to look him up again to see what all he did, but I think it's going to be an interesting set of films.
Even the worst ones, even the, like, even Battle, which I would say kind of is like, seems as if they run out of the budget and are kind of low on ideas. It's not really terrible. I like it. I really do like it. Tim Burton's, I wouldn't even say I hate it because I think as a kid, I enjoyed it. But anytime I've seen it on TV since, I haven't been able to watch the whole thing. Like, I've watched the beginning of it maybe five times without finishing the movie. Like, and it's not that I've had things to do. I just get bored of it. And so I think it'll be interesting when we finally do get back to that film. But yeah, definitely what you were saying, we definitely have a lot to talk about for each film. Because luckily, when we get to sequels, for the most part, they're not repeating the same formula again. They reinvent the wheel several times, and it keeps it interesting. Yeah. It's not like it's an anthology series, but they tackle each one completely different. It'd be like if I was writing Planet of the Apes and I said, "Chuck, start writing the sequel," and you said, "Well, what's yours about?" It doesn't matter. Just make your own.
Yeah. What, you come up with your own ideas and we'll make it work later.
Yeah, whatever you think's interesting is going to be interesting. Just leave it at that. So your favorite character is Zaius in this, you would say?
I think so. Yeah, I'd probably say him. Like I said, he's definitely the most interesting and most well-written out of any of the characters. I'd say between... It really is the apes, I think, are more interesting overall. Him, Zira, and Cornelius are all... They're all pretty well done, and obviously Zira and Cornelius, again, become kind of the main characters through more of the films than anybody else. They're... Roddy McDowall, who plays Cornelius, has been in more apes things than any other actor. He was in almost every movie except the second one and the TV show. And like some special I think they did later after that. So, you know, I think those three are the three more interesting of the characters, but in at least especially in this first film, I feel like a lot of the stuff with Zaius is very, very interesting, and he's definitely my favorite out of this first one.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's his complexity. Even when Charlton Heston's leaving at the end of the movie, and the other eight, the gorillas are going to go after him, and he's just like, let him go. It's another thing where he's confident that there's nothing good that can possibly happen, and it's not like they're going to be able to come back and explain themselves. So, like, he's very confident that Charlton Heston's not gonna make it very far.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're going towards some nuclear web... like war site or something, you know, they're gonna all get radiated and die, right?
Yeah, could be.
Yeah. We are going to take these episodes, and obviously this one's Friday, but for the next 4 weeks, we're going to do two a week. So next week we'll do Beneath on Tuesday and Escape on Friday, and we'll just keep that up for 4 more weeks. But this is the big, exciting theme that we decided to throw at you. And we might have guests. It just didn't work out for this episode.
Yeah, we'll see. Might have a rotating cast coming in and out for some of these episodes.
We're Cinema D'Amore. Thank you for listening to our Planet of the Apes episodes. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date with news and information on upcoming episodes. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, Pandora, Alexa, or iHeartRadio. It'd be greatly appreciated if you would subscribe to our podcast on your platform of choice. We also appreciate feedback, so rate us, review us, and let us know what you think. And above all else, thank you for listening.